Chapter I on the banks of the great Amazon. Miles upon miles from the banks of the mighty river, had you wandered far away in the shade of the dark forest that clothed the valleys and struggled high over the mountaintops themselves, you would have heard the roar and the boom of that great buzzsaw. As early as 6 a.m. it would start, or soon after the sun, like a huge red hotshot, had leapt up from his bed in the glowing east behind the greenery of the hills and woods primeval. To a stranger coming from the south towards the Amazon, great queen of all the rivers on earth, and not knowing he was on the borders of civilization, the sound that the huge saw made would have been decidedly alarming. He would have stopped and listened, and listening, wondered. No menagerie of wild beasts could have sent forth a noise so loud, so strange, so persistent. Harsh and low at times, as its great teeth tore through the planks of timber, it would change presently into a dull but dreadful underscore basso profundo underscore, such as might have been emitted by antediluvian monsters in the agonies of death or torture, rising anon into a shrill howl or a shriek, then subsiding once again into a steady grating roar, that seemed to shake the very earth. Wild beasts in this black forest heard the sounds, and crept stealthily away to hide themselves in their caves and dens. Caimans or alligators heard them too, as they basked in the morning sunshine by lakelet or stream, heard them and crawled away into caves, or took to the water with a sullen plunge that caused the finny inhabitants to dart away in terror to every point of the compass. "Up with the tree, lads. Feed him home," cried Jake Solomons loudly but cheerily. "Our pet is hungry this morning. I say, Bill, doesn't she look a beauty? Ever see such teeth, and how they shine, too, in the red sunlight? Guess you never did, Bill. I say, what chance would the biggest gator that ever crawled have with Betsy here? Why, if Betsy got one tooth in his hide, she'd have 50 before you could say Jerusalem, and that gator'd be cut in two. Tear away, Betsy. Grind and groan and growl, my lass. Have your breakfast, my little pet. Why, your voice is sweetest music to my ear. I say, Bill, don't the sawdust fly a few? I should smile. But see," he continued, "yonder come the darkies with our machetinal. Girls and boys with baskets, and I can see the steam curling up under Chloe's arm from the great flag and she is carrying. Look how her white eyes roll, and her white teeth shine as she smiles her 6-inch smile. Good girl is Chloe. She knows we're hungry, and that we'll welcome her. Whoa, now, Betsy. Let the water off, Bill. Betsy has had her snack, and so we'll have ours." There was quietness now o'er hill and dell and forest land. And this tall Yankee, Jake Solomons, who was fully arrayed in cotton shirt and trousers, his brown arms bare to the shoulder, stretched his splendidly knit but spare form with a sort of a yawn. "Hi-yo, Bill," he said. "I'm pining for breakfast. Aren't you?" "That I am," replied Burly Bill with his broadest grin. Jake ran to the open side of the great sawmill. 3 or 4 strides took him there. "Ah. Good morning, Chloe, darling. Morning, Chemo. Morning, Chemo. Morning, Sa." This was a chorus. "All along day blessed good phone nuff and boys I know come so kayak," said Chloe. "Stay, stay, Chloe," cried Jake, "never let your angry passions rise. Sides, Chloe, I calculate such language ain't half proper. But how glittering your cheeks are, Chloe, how white your teeth. There. You smile again. And that vermilion blouse sets off your dark complexion to a nicety, and seems just made for it. Chloe, I would kiss you, but the fear of making Bill jealous holds me back." Burly Bill shook with laughter. Bill was well named the Burly. Though not so tall as Jake, his frame was immense, though perhaps there was a little more adipose tissue about it than was necessary in a climate like this. But Bill's strength was wonderful. See him, axe in hand, at the foot of a tree. How the chips fly. How set and determined the man's face, while the great beads of sweat stand like pearls on his brow. Burly Bill was a white man turned black. You couldn't easily have guessed his age. Perhaps he was 40, but at 20, when still in England, Bill was supple and lithe, and had a skin as white as a schoolboy's. But he had got stouter as the years rolled on, and his face tanned and tanned till it tired of tanning, and first grew purple, and latterly almost black. The same with those hirsute bare arms of his. There was none of the wild ha, ha, about Bill's laughter. It was a sort of suppressed chuckle, that agitated all his anatomy, the while his merry good-natured eyes sought shelter behind his cheek's rotundity. Under a great spreading tree the two men laid themselves down, and Chloe spread their breakfast on a white cloth between them, Jake keeping up his fire of chaff and sweet nothings while she did so. Chemo, and the other good phone-uffin boys had brought their morning meal to the men who fed the great buzzsaw. "Ah, Chloe. said Jake, the odor of that coffee would bring the dead to life, and the fish and the beef and the butter, Chloe. Did you do all this yourself?
All, saw, I do all. The boys just kick about the kitchen and do nothing.
Dear tender-eyed Chloe. How clever you are. Guess you won't be so kind to me when you and I get spliced, eh?
Aw, saw. You no care to marry a poor black gal like Chloe.
There is a sweet little white missy waiting somewhere as foam asa Jake. I be your maid, and shine yo boots till all de same is massa Bill's cheek fo true.
As soon as Chloe with her good phone up and boys had cleared away the breakfast things, and retired with a smile and saucy toss of her curly poll, the men lay back and lit their pipes.
She's a bright intelligent girl that, said Jake. I don't want a wife or but I say, Bill, why don't you marry her? I guess she'd make ye a tip-topper.
Me. Is it Mary?
Burly Bill held back his head and chuckled till he well nigh choked. Honest Bill's ordinary English showed that he came from the old country, and more particularly from the Midlands. But Bill could talk properly enough when he pleased, as will soon be seen. He smoked quietly enough for a time, but every now and then he felt constrained to take his meerschaum from his mouth and give another chuckle or two.
Choo-hoo-hoo. He laughed. Me Mary. And Mary Chloe.
Choo-hoo-hoo.
To change the subject, William, said Jake, seeing as how you've pretty nearly chuckled yourself silly, or darned near it, how long have you left England?
Why, I come over with Mr. St. Clair hisself, and Roland why he weren't more in 7.
Look at he now, and dear little Peggy, his sister by adoption as ever was, weren't a month over 4. Now Roly E B's nigh on to 15, and Peggy the jewel of the plantation she's going on for 12, and main tall for that. Why time do fly. Don't she, Jake?
Well, I guess I've been here 5 years, and darn me if I want to leave.
Could we have a better home? I'd like to see it. I'd smile a few on ones. But listen, why here comes the young'uns?
There was the clatter of ponies' feet, and next minute as handsome a boy as ever sat in saddle, and as pretty and bright a lassie as you could wish to meet, galloped into the clearing, and reined up their spirited little steeds close to the spot where the men were lounging.
Burly Bill stuck his thumb into the bowl of his meerschaum to put it out, and Jake threw his pipe on the bank.
Roland was tall for his age, like Peggy. But while a mass of fair and irrepressible hair curled around the boy's sunburned brow, Peggy's hair was straight and black. When she rode fast it streamed out behind her like pennons in the breeze. What a bright and sunny face was hers too. There was ever a happy smile about her red lips and dark eyes.
You've got to begin to smoke again immediately, said the boy.
No, no, Master Roland, not in the presence of your sister.
But, cried Peggy, with a pretty show of pomposity, I command you.
Ah, then, indeed, said Jake, and soon both men were blowing clouds that made the very mosquitoes change their quarters.
Father'll be up soon, riding on Glancer. This nag through father, coming home last night.
Mind, Glancer is 17 hands and over.
He threw him?
That he did, in the moonlight. Scared at a gator. Father says he heard the gator's great teeth snapping and thought he was booked. But lo! Jake, at that very moment Glancer struck out with both hind legs, you know how he is shod. He smashed the gator's skull, and the beast turned up his yellow belly to the moon.
Bravo!
Then father mounted mighty Glancer and rode quietly home.
Peggy and I, he continued, have ridden along the bank to the battlefield to hold a coroner's inquest on the gator, but he's been hauled away by his relations. I suppose they'll make potato soup of him.
Burly Bill chuckled.
Well, Peggy and I are off. See you in the evening, Jake.
Bye-bye.
And away they rode, like a couple of wild Indians, followed by a huge Irish wolfhound, as faithful a dog to his mistress for he was Peggy's own pet as ever dog could be. They were going to have a day in the forest, and each carried a short 6-chambered rifle at the saddle. A country like the wild one in which they dwelt soon makes anyone brave and fearless. They meant to ride quite a long way today and not return till the sun began to decline in the far and wooded west. So, being already quite an old campaigner, Roland had not forgotten to bring luncheon with him, and some for Bold Brawn also. Into the forest they dashed, leaving the mighty river, which was there about 15 miles broad probably, in their rear. They knew every pathway of that primeval woodland, and it mattered but little to them that most of these had been worn by the feet of wild beasts. Such tracks wind out and in, and in and out, and meet others in the most puzzling and labyrinthine manner. Roland carried a compass, and knew how to use it, but the day was unusually fine and sunny, so there was little chance of their getting lost. The country in which they lived might well have been called the land of perpetual summer.
but at some spots the forest was so pitchy dark, owing to the overhanging trees and wild flowering creepers, that they had to rein up and allow Kaz and Boz, as their ponies were named, to cautiously feel the way for themselves. How far away they might have ridden they could not themselves tell, had they not suddenly entered a kind of fairy glade. At one side it was bounded by a crescentic formation of rock, from the very center of which spouted a tiny clear crystal waterfall. Beneath was a deep pool, the bottom of which was sand and yellow shingle, with here and there a patch of snow-white quartz. And away from this a little stream went meandering slowly through the glade, keeping it green. On the other side were the lordly forest trees, bedraped with flowering orchids and ferns. Flowers and ferns grew here and there in the rock face itself. No wonder the young folks gazed around them in delighted wonder. Braun was more practical. He cared nothing for the flowers, but enjoyed to the fullest extent the clear cool water of the crystal pool.
"Oh, isn't it lovely?" said Roland.
"And oh, I am so hungry, Rolly."
Rolly took the hint. The ponies were let loose to graze, Braun being told to head them off if they attempted to take to the woods.
"I understand," said Braun, with an intelligent glance of his brown eyes and wag of his tail. Then down the boy and girl squatted with the noble wolfhound beside them, and Roland speedily spread the banquet onto moss. I dare say that hunger and romance seldom tread the same platform at the same time, that is. It is usually one down, the other up, and notwithstanding the extraordinary beauty of their surroundings, for some time both boy and girl applied themselves assiduously to the discussion of the good things before them, that meat pie disappearing as if by magic. Then the hard-boiled eggs, the well-buttered and floweriest of flowery scones, received their attention, and the whole was washed down with underscore vinum bovis underscore, as Roland called it, cow's wine, or good milk. Needless to say, Braun, whose eyes sparkled like diamonds, and whose ears were conveniently erect, came in for a good share. Well, but the ponies, Boz and Kaz, had not the remotest idea of running away. In fact they soon drew near to the banqueting table. Kaz laid his nose affectionately on his little mistress's shoulder and heaved an equine sigh, and Boz began to nibble at Roland's ears in a very winning way. And the nibbling and the sigh brought them cakes galore. Roland offered Boz a bit of pie. The pony drew back, as if to say, "Vegetarians, weren't you aware?" But Braun cocked his bonny head to one side, knowingly. "Pitch it this way, master," he said. "I've got a crop for any kind of corn, and a bag for peas." A strange little rodent creature, much bigger than any rat, however, with beautiful sad-looking eyes, came from the bush, and stood on its hind legs begging, not a yard away. Its breast was as white as snow. Probably it had no experience of the genus underscore homo underscore, and all the cruelties he is guilty of, under the title of sport. Roland pitched several pieces of pie towards the innocent. It just tasted a morsel, then back it ran towards the wood with wondrous speed. If they thought they had seen the last of it, they were much mistaken, for the innocent returned in 2 minutes' time, accompanied not only by another of his own size, but by half a dozen of the funniest little fairies ever seen inside a forest. "My wife and children," said innocent number one. "My services to you," bobbed innocent number two. But the young ones squawked and squealed, and tumbled and leapt over each other as they fed in a manner so droll that boy and girl had to laugh till the woods rang. Innocent number one looked on most lovingly, but took not a morsel to himself. Then all disappeared as suddenly as they had come. Truly the student of nature who betakes himself to lonely woods sees many wonders. It was time now to lie back in the moss and enjoy the underscore dolce far niente underscore. The sky was as blue as blue could be, all between the rifts of slowly moving clouds. The whisper of the wind among the forest trees, and the murmur of the falling water, came like softest music to Roland's ears. Small wonder, therefore, that his eyes closed, and he was soon in the land of sweet forgetfulness. But Peggy had a tiny book, from which she read passages to Braun, who seemed all attention, but kept one eye on the ponies at the same time. It was a copy of the Song of Hiawatha, a poem which Peggy thought ineffably lovely. Hark to her sweet girl voice as she reads. These songs so wild and wayward, these legends and traditions. They appealed to her simple soul, for dearly did she love the haunts of nature. Loved the sunshine of the meadow, loved the shadow of the forest, loved the wind among the branches, the rushing of great rivers through their palisades of pine trees. She believed, too, that even in savage bosoms there are longings, yearnings, strivings for the good they comprehend not, that feeble hands and helpless, groping blindly in the darkness, touch God's right hand, and are lifted up and strengthened. Dash.
Roland slumbered quietly, and the day went on apace. He slept so peacefully that she hardly liked to arouse him. The little red book dropped from her hand and fell on the moss, and her thoughts now went far, far away adown the mighty river that flows so sadly, so solemnly onwards to the great Atlantic Ocean, fed on its way by 100 rapid streams that melt in its dark bosom and are seen never more. But it was not the river itself the little maiden's thoughts were dwelling on, not the strange wild birds that sailed along its surface on snow-white wings, not the birds of prey the eagle and the hawk that hovered high in air, or with eldritch screams darted on their prey like bolts from the blue, and bore their bleeding quarries away to the silent forest, not even the wealth of wild flowers that nodded over the banks of the mighty stream. Her thoughts were on board a tall and darksome raft that was slowly making its way seaward to distant Bara, or in the boats that towed it. For there was someone on the raft or in those boats who even then might be fondly thinking of the dark-haired maiden he had left behind. But Peggy's awakening from her dream of romance, and Roland's from his slumber, was indeed a terrible one. Chapter 2 Strange Adventures in the Forest Lost. Fierce Eyes had been watching the little camp for an hour and more, glaring out on the sunny glade from the dark depths of a forest tree not far off, out from under a cloudland of waving foliage that rustled in the balmy wind. Watching, and watching unwaveringly, Peggy, while she read, watching the sleeping Roland, the great wolfhound, Brawn, and watching the ponies too. Ever and anon these last would come closer to the tree, as they nibbled grass or moss, then those fierce eyes burned more fiercely, and the cat-like tail of a monster jaguar moved uneasily as if the wild beast meditated a spring. But the ponies, sniffing danger in the air, perhaps who can tell? Would toss their manes and retreat to the shadow of the rocks. Had the dog not been there the beast would have dared all, and sprung at once on one of those nimble steeds. But he waited and watched, watched and waited, and at long last his time came. With a coughing roar he now launched himself into the air, the elasticity of the branch giving greater force to his spring. Straight on the shoulders or back of poor Boz he alighted. His talons were well driven home, his white teeth were preparing to tear the flesh from the pony's neck. Both little steeds yelled wildly, and in nightmarish terror. Up sprang Brawn, the wolfhound, and dashed on to the rescue. Peggy seized her loaded rifle and hurried after him. Thoroughly awake now, and fully cognizant of the terrible danger, Roland too was quickly on the scene of action. To fire at a distance were madness. He might have missed the struggling lion and shot poor Boz, or even faithful Brawn. This enormous dog had seized the beast by one hawk, and with his paws against the pony was endeavoring to tear the monster off. The noise, the movement, the terror, caused poor Roland's head to whirl. He felt dazed, and almost stupid. Ah! But Peggy was clear-headed, and a brave and fearless child was she. Her feet seemed hardly to touch the moss, so lightly did she spring along. Her little rifle was cocked and ready, and, taking advantage of a few seconds lull in the fearful scrimmage, she fired at 5 yards distance. The bullet found billet behind the monster's ear, his grip relaxed, and now Brawn tore him easily from his perch and finished him off on the ground, with awful din and habbering. Then, with blood-dripping jaws he came with his ears lower, half apologetically, to receive the praise and caresses of his master and mistress. But though the adventure ended thus happily, frightened beyond measure, the ponies, Coz and Buzz, had taken to the bush and disappeared. Knowing well the danger of the situation, Roland and Peggy, with Brawn, tried to follow them. But Irish wolfhounds have but little scent, and so they searched and searched in vain, and returned at last to the sun-kissed glade. It was now well on towards 3 o'clock, and as they had a long forest stretch of at least 10 miles before them ere they could touch the banks of the great Queen of Waters, Roland determined, with the aid of his compass, to strike at once into the beast-trodden pathway by which they had come, and make all haste homewards before the sun should set and darkness envelop the gloomy forest. Keep up your heart, Peggy, if your courage and your feet hold out we shall reach the river before dusk. I'm not so frightened now, said Peggy, but her lips were very tremulous, and tears stood in her eyes. Come, come, she cried, let us hurry on. Come, Brawn, good dog. Brawn leapt up to lick her ear, and taking no thought for the skin of the jaguar, which in more favorable circumstances would have been borne away as a trophy, and proof of Peggy's valor, they now took to the bush in earnest. Roland looked at his watch. 3 hours of light and more. Ah! We can do it, if we do not lose our way. So off they set. Roland took the lead, rifle in hand, Peggy came next, and brave Brawn brought up the rear. They were compelled to walk in single file, for the pathways were so narrow in places that two could not have gone abreast. Roland made constant reference to his little compass, always assuring his companion that they were still heading directly for the river. They had hurried on for nearly an hour, when Roland suddenly paused. A huge dark monster had leapt clear and clean across the pathway some distance ahead, and taken refuge in a tree. It was, no doubt, another jaguar, and to advance unannounced might mean certain death to one of the three. "Are you all loaded, Peggy?" said Roland. "Every chamber," replied the girl. There was no tremor about her now, and no backwoods Indian could have acted more coolly and courageously. "Blaze away at that tree then, Peg." Peggy opened fire, throwing in three or four shots in rapid succession. The beast, with a terrible cry, darted out of the tree and came rushing along to meet and fight the little party. "Down, Brawn, down. To heel, sir." Next moment Roland fired, and with a terrible shriek the jaguar took to the bush, wounded and bleeding, and was seen no more. But his yells had awakened the echoes of the forest, and for more than 5 minutes the din of roaring, growling, and shrieking was fearful. Wild birds, no doubt, helped to swell the pandemonium. After a time, however, all was still once more, and the journey was continued in silence. Even Peggy, usually the first to commence a conversation, felt in no mood for talking now. She was very tired. Her feet ached, her brow was hot, and her eyes felt as if boiling in their sockets. Roland had filled his large flask at the little waterfall before leaving the glade, and he now made her drink. The draught seemed to renew her strength, and she struggled on as bravely as ever. Dash. Just 2.5 hours after they had left the forest clearing, and when Roland was holding out hopes that they should soon reach the road by the banks of the river, much to their astonishment they found themselves in a strange clearing which they had never seen before. The very pathway ended here, and though the boy went round and round the circle, he could find no exit. To retrace his steps and try to find out the right path was the first thought that occurred to Roland. This plan was tried, but tried in vain, and so weary and hopeless now beyond measure they returned to the center of the glade and threw themselves down on the soft green moss. "Lost! Lost!" The words kept repeating themselves in poor Roland's brain, but Peggy's fatigue was so complete that she preferred rest even in the midst of danger to going farther. Brawn, heaving a great sigh, laid himself down beside them. The warm day wore rapidly to a close, and at last the sun shimmered red through the forest trees. Then it sank. The briefest of twilight, and the stars shone out. 2 hours of starlight, then solemnly uprose the round moon and flooded all the glade, draping the whispering trees in a blue glare, beautifully etherealizing them. "Sorrow bringeth sleep. Good night, Roy. Say your prayers," murmured Peggy. There were stars in the sky. There were stars too that flitted from bush to bush, while the winds made murmuring music among the lofty branches. Peggy was repeating to herself lines that she had read that very day. "The firefly wah wah te see, flitting through the dusk of evening, with the twinkle of its candle, lighting up the brakes and bushes. Wah wah te see, little firefly, little, flitting, white fire insect, little dancing, white fire creature, light me with your little candle. Ere upon my bed I lay me, ere in sleep I close my eyelids." Dash. The forest was unusually silent tonight, but ever and anon might be heard some distant growl showing that the woods shelter the wildest beasts, or an owl with mournful cry would flap its silent wings as it flew across the clearing. But nothing waked those tired and weary sleepers. So the night wore on and on. The moon had reached the zenith, and was shining now with a luster that almost rivaled daylight itself. It must have been well on towards 2 o'clock in the morning when Brawn emitted a low and threatening growl. This roused both Roland and Peggy, and the former at once seized his rifle. Standing there in the pale moonlight, not 20 yards away, was a tall, dark-skinned, and powerful-looking Indian. In his right hand he held a spear or something resembling one, in his left a huge catapult or sling. He was dressed for comfort, certainly not for ornament. Leggings or galligaskins covered his lower extremities, while his body was wrapped in a blanket. He had no head covering, save a matted mass of hair, in which were stuck a few feathers. Roland took all this in at a glance as he seized his rifle and prepared for eventualities. According to the traditional painter of Indian life and customs, the proper thing for this savage to have said is "Uck." He said nothing of the sort. Nor did he give vent to a whoop and yell that would have awakened the wild birds and beasts of the forest and every echo far and near. "Who goes there?" cried Roland, raising his gun. "No shootee. No shootee, poor Indian man. I friendy you. Plenty friendy." Probably there was a little romance about Roland, For, instead of saying, "Come this way then, old chap, squat down and give us the news," he said sternly, "Advance, friend." But the Indian stood like a statue. No one dast and defo true. And Roland had to climb down and say simply, "Come here, friend, and speak." Braun rushed forward now, but he looked a terror, for his hair was all on end like a hyena's, and he growled low but fiercely, "Down, Braun. It's a good man, Braun." Braun smelt the Indian's hand, and, seeming satisfied, went back to the spot where Peggy sat wondering and frightened. She gathered the great dog to her breast and hugged and kissed him. "What fo you po chill and sleepy all in a wood so? Spose wild bears come eat to you, what den you do?" "But, friend," replied Roland, "we are far from Burnley Hall, our home, and we have lost everything. We have lost our ponies, lost our way, and lost ourselves." "Pochillin," said this strange being. "But now go sleepy fo true. Dindy and he lie on blanket. He watch he till the big sunrise." "Can we trust him, Peggy?"
"Oh yes, yes," returned Peggy. "He is a dear, good man, I know by his voice." In 10 minutes more the boy and girl were fast asleep. The Indian watched. And Braun watched the Indian. Dash. When the sun went down on the previous evening, and there were no signs of the young folks returning, both Mr. St. Clair and his wife became very uneasy indeed. Then 2 long hours of darkness ensued before the moon sailed up, first reddening, then silvering, the wavelets and ripples on the great river. "Surely some evil must have befallen them," moaned Mrs. St. Clair.
"Oh, my Roland. My son. I may never see you more. Is there nothing can be done? Tell me. Tell me."
"We must trust in Providence, Mary, and it is wrong to mourn. I doubt not the children are safe, although perhaps they have lost their way in the woods." Hours of anxious waiting went by, and it was nearly midnight. The house was very quiet and still, for the servants were asleep. Burly Bill and Jake had mounted strong horses at moonrise, and gone off to try to find a clue. But they knew it was in vain, nay, 'twould have been sheer madness to enter the forest now. They cooed over and over again, but their only answer was the echoing shriek of the wild birds. They were just about to return after giving their last shrill cooee, when out from the moonlit forest, with a fond whinny, sprang Coz and Buzz. Jake sprang out of his saddle, throwing his bridle to Bill. In the bright moonlight, Jake could see at once that there was something wrong. He placed his hand on Buzz's shoulder. He staggered back as he withdrew it.
"Oh, Bill," he cried, "here is blood, and the pony is torn and bleeding. Only a jaguar could have done this. This is terrible."
"Let us return at once," said Bill, who had a right soft heart of his own behind his burly chest.
"But oh," he added, "how can we break the news to Roland's parents?
We'll give them hope. Mrs. St. Clair must know nothing yet, but at early dawn all the ranch must be roused, and we shall search the forest for miles and miles."
Dash. Jake, after seeing the ponies safe in their stable, left Bill to look to Boz's wounds, while with St. Clair's leave he himself set off at a round gallop to get assistance from a neighboring ranch. Day had not yet broken ere 40 good men and true were on the bridle path and tearing along the river's banks. St. Clair himself was at their head. I must leave the reader to imagine the joy of all the party when soon after sunrise there emerged from the forest, guided by the strange Indian, Roland, Peggy, and noble Braun, all looking as fresh as the dew on the tender-eyed hibiscus bloom or the wild flowers that nodded by the river's brim.
"Wirrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrrr
every feature of his noble face, and I declare to you there seemed to be a lump in his throat, and the sound of his barking was half hysterical. St. Clair could not utter a word as he fondly embraced the children. He pretended to scold a little, but this was all bluff, and simply a ruse to keep back the tears. But soft-hearted Burly Bill was less successful. He just managed to drop a little to the rear, and it was not once only that he was fain to draw the sleeve of his rough jacket across his eyes. Dash. But now they are mounted, and the horses' heads are turned homewards. Peggy is seated in front of Burly Bill, of whom she is very fond, and Roland is saddled with Jake. The Indian and Brawn ran. Poor Mrs. St. Clair, at the big lawn gate, gazing westward, sees the cavalcade far away on the horizon. Presently, borne along on the morning breeze come voices raised in a brave and joyous song. Down with them, down with the lords of the forest. And she knows her boy and Peggy are safe. Thank God for all his mercies. She says fervently, then, womanlike,
bursts into tears.
Chapter 3 Burnley Hall, Old and New. I have noticed more than once that although the life story of some good old families in England may run long stagnant, still, when one important event does take place, strange thing after strange thing may happen, and the story rushes on with heedless speed, like rippling brooklets to the sea. The St. Clairs may have been originally a Scottish family, or branch of some Highland clan, but they had been settled on a beautiful estate, far away in the wilds of Cornwall, for over 150 years. Stay, though, we are not going back so far as that. Old history, like old parchment, has a musty odor. Let us come down to more modern times. When, then, young Roland's grandfather died, and died intestate, the whole of the large estate devolved upon his eldest son, with its fat rentals of fully 4,000 a year. Peggy St. Clair, our little heroine, was his only child, and said to be, even in her infancy, the very image of her dead and gone mother. No wonder her father loved her. But soon the first great event happened in the life story of the St. Clairs. For, one sad day Peggy's father was borne home from the hunting field grievously wounded. All hope of recovery was abandoned by the doctor shortly after he had examined his patient. Were Herbert to die intestate, as his father had done, his second brother John, according to the old law, could have stepped into his shoes and become Lord of Burnley Hall and all its broad acres. But, alive to the peril of his situation, which the surgeon with tears in his eyes pointed out to him, the dying man sent at once for his solicitor, and a will was drawn up and placed in this lawyer's hands, and moreover he was appointed one of the executors. This will was to be kept in a safe until Peggy should be 17 years of age, when it was to be opened and read. I must tell you that between the brothers Herbert and John there had long existed a sort of blood feud, and it was as well they never met. Thomas, however, was quickly at his wounded brother's bedside, and never left it until Clay Cold Death had closed his eye. The surgeon had never given any hopes, yet during the week that intervened between the terrible accident and Herbert's death there were many hours in which the doomed man appeared as well as ever, though scarce able to move hand or foot. His mind was clear at such times, and he talked much with Thomas about the dear old times when all were young. Up till now this youngest son and brother, Thomas, had led rather an uneasy and eventful life. Nothing prospered with him, though he had tried most things. He was married, and had the one child, Roland, to whom the reader has already been introduced. "Now, dear Tom," said Herbert, one evening after he had lain still with closed eyes for quite a long time, and he placed a white cold hand in that of his brother as he spoke, "I am going to leave you. We have always been good friends and loved each other well. All I need tell you now, and I tell you in confidence, is that Peggy, at the age of 17, will be my heir, with you, dear Tom, as her guardian." Tom could not reply for the gathering tears. He just pressed Herbert's hand in silence. "Well," continued the latter, "things have not gone over well with you, I know, but I have often heard you say you could do capitally if you emigrated to an almost new land, a land you said figuratively flowing with milk and honey. I confess I made no attempt to assist you to go to the great valley of the Amazon. It was for a selfish reason I detained you. My brother John being nobody to me, my desire was to have you near." He paused, almost exhausted, and Tom held a little cup of wine to his lips. Presently he spoke again. "My little Peggy," he moaned. "Oh, it is hard, hard to leave my darling. Tom, listen. You are to take Peggy to your home. You are to care for her as the apple of your eye. You must be her father, your wife her mother." "I will. I will. Oh, brother, can you doubt me?" "No, no, Tom. And now you may emigrate. I leave you £30,000, all my deposit account at Messrs. Bullion and Company's bank. This is for Peggy and you. My real will is a secret at present, and that which will be read after I go, is a mere epitome. But in future it will be found that I have not forgotten even John." Poor Peggy had run in just then, and perched upon the bed, wondering much that her father should lie there so pale and still, and make no attempt to romp with her. At this time her hair was as yellow as the first approach of dawn in the eastern sky. Dash. That very week poor Squire St. Clair breathed his last. John came to the funeral with a long face and a crape-covered hat, looking more like a mute than anything else. He sipped his wine while the epitomized will was read, but a wicked light flashed from his eyes, and he ground out an oath at its conclusion. All the information anyone received was that those sums varying from £500 to £1,000 were left as little legacies to distant relations and to John, as well as _dues__ to the servants. The whole of the estates were willed in a way that could not be divulged for many a long year.
John seized his hat, tore from it the crepe, and dashed it on the floor. The crepe on his arm followed suit. He trampled on both and strode away, slamming the door behind him. Years had flown away. Tom and his wife had emigrated to the banks of the Amazon. They settled but a short time at or near one of its mouths, and then Tom, who had no lack of enterprise, determined to journey far, far into the interior, where the land was not so level, where mountains nodded to the moon, and giant forests stretched illimitably to the southward and west. At first Tom and his men, with faithful Bill as overseer, were mere squatters, but squatters by the banks of the Queen of Waters, and in a far more lovely place than dreams of Elfinland. Labor was very cheap here, and the Indians soon learned from the white men how to work. Tom St. Clair had imported carpenters and artificers of many sorts from the old country, to say nothing of steam plant and machinery, and that great resounding steel buzzsaw. Now, although not really extravagant, he had an eye for the beautiful, and determined to build himself a house and home that, although not costing a deal, would be in reality a miniature Burnley Hall. And what a truly joyous time Peggy and her cousin, or adopted brother, had of it while the house was gradually being built by the busy hands of the trained Indians and their white brethren. Not they alone, but also a boy called Dick Temple, whose uncle was Tom St. Clair's nearest neighbor, that is, he lived a trifle over 7 miles higher up the river. Dick was about the same age and build as Roland. There was a good road between Temple's ranch and Tom St. Clair's place, and when, after a time, Tom and Peggy had a tutor imported for their own especial benefit, the two families became very friendly indeed. Dick Temple was a well set up and really brave and good looking lad. Little Peggy averred that there never had been, or never could be, another boy half so nice as Dick. But I may as well state here at once and be done with it. Dick was simply a reckless, wild daredevil. Nothing else would suffice to describe young Dick's character even at this early age. And he soon taught Roland to be as reckless as himself. Dash. Time rolled on, and the new Burnley Hall was _fait accompli_. The site chosen by Tom for his home by the river was a rounded and wooded hill about a quarter of a mile back from the immediate bank of the stream. But all the land between the hill and the Amazon was cultivated, and not only this, but up and down the river as well for over a mile, for St. Clair wanted to avoid too close contact with unfriendly alligators, and these scaly reptiles avoid land on which crops are growing. The tall trees were first and foremost cleared off the hill, not although. Many of the most beautiful were left for effect, not to say shade, and it was pleasant indeed to hear the wind whispering through their foliage, and the bees murmuring in their branches, in this flowery land of eternal summer. Nor was the undergrowth of splendid shrubs and bushes and fruit trees cleared away. They were thinned, however, and beautiful broad winding walks led up through them towards the mansion. The house was one of many gables, altogether English, built of quartz for the most part, and having a tower to it of great height. From this tower one could catch glimpses of the most charming scenery, up and down the river, and far away on the other shore, where forests swam in the liquid air and giant hills raised their blue tops far into the sky. So well had Tom St. Clair flourished since taking up his quarters here that his capital was returning him at least 100%, after allowing for wear and tear of plant. I could not say for certain how many white men he had with him. The number must have been close on 50, to say nothing of the scores and scores of Indians. Jake Solomons and Burly Bill were his overseers, but they delighted in hard work themselves, as we have already seen. So, too, did Roland's father himself, and as visitors to the district were few, you may be certain he never wore a London hat nor evening dress. Like those of Jake and Bill, his sleeves were always rolled up, and his muscular arms and brave square face showed that he was fit for anything. No, a London hat would have been sadly out of place, but the broad-brimmed Buffalo Bill he wore became him admirably. That big buzzsaw was a triumph. The clearing of the forest commenced from close under the hill where stood the mansion, and strong horses and bullocks were used to drag the gigantic trees towards the mill. Splendid timber it was. No one could have guessed the age of these trees until they were cut down and sawn into lengths, when their concentric rings might be counted. The sawmill itself was a long way from the mansion house, with the villages for the whites and Indians between, but quite separate from each other. The habitations of the whites were raised on piles well above the somewhat damp ground, and steps led up to them. Two-roomed most of them were, but that of Jake was of a more pretentious character. So, too, was Burly Bill's hut. It would have been difficult to say what the Indians lived on. Cakes, fruit, fish, and meat of any kind might form the best answer to the question. They ate roasted snakes with great relish, and many of these were of the deadly poisonous class. The heads were cut off and buried first, however,
and thus all danger was prevented. Young alligators were frequently caught, too, and made into a stew. The huts these faithful creatures lived in were chiefly composed of bamboo, timber, and leaves. Sometimes they caught fire. That did not trouble the savages much, and certainly did not keep them awake at night. For, had the whole village been burned down, they could have built another in a surprisingly short time. When our hero and heroine got lost in the great primeval forest, Burnley Hall was in the most perfect and beautiful order, and its walks, its flower garden, and shrubberies were a most pleasing sight. All was under the superintendence of a Scotch gardener, whom St. Clair had imported for the purpose. By this time, too, a very large portion of the adjoining forest had been cut down, and the land on which those lofty trees had grown was under cultivation. If the country which St. Clair had made his home was not in reality a land flowing with milk and honey, it yielded many commodities equally valuable. Every now and then, especially when the river was more or less in flood, immense rafts were sent downstream to distant Barra, where the valuable timber found ready market. Several white men in boats always went in charge of these, and the boats served to assist in steering, and towing as well. These rafts used often to be built close to the river before an expected rising of the stream, which, when it did come, floated them off and away. But timber was not the only commodity that St. Clair sent down from his great estate. There were splendid quinine trees. There was coca and cocoa, too. There was a sugar plantation which yielded the best results, to say nothing of coffee and tobacco, Brazil nuts and many other kinds of nuts, and last, but not least, there was gold. This latter was invariably sent in charge of a reliable white man, and St. Clair lived in hope that he would yet manage to position a really paying gold mine. More than once St. Clair had permitted Roland and Peggy to journey down to Para on a great raft. But only at the season when no storms blew. They had an old Indian servant to cook and do for them, and the center of the raft was hollowed out into a kind of cabin roofed over with bamboo and leaves. Steps led up from this onto a railed platform, which was called the deck. Burly Bill would be in charge of boats and all, and in the evenings he would enter the children's cabin to sing them songs and tell them strange, weird tales of forest life. He had a banjo, and right sweetly could he play. Old Biba the Indian would invariably light his meerschaum for him, smoking it herself for a good 5 minutes first and foremost, under pretense of getting it well alight. Bibu, indeed, was altogether a character. Both Mr. and Mrs. St. Clair liked her very much, however, for she had been in the family, and nursed both Peggy and Roland, from the day they had first come to the country. As for her age, she might have been any age between 5 and 20 and 110. She was dark in skin, not black, but more of copper color, and showed a few wrinkles at early morn. But when Biba was figged out in her nicest white frock and her deep blue or crimson blouse, with her hair hanging down in two huge plaits, then, with the smile that always hovered around her lips and went dancing away up her face till it flickered about her eyes, she was very pleasant indeed. The wrinkles had all flown up to the moon or somewhere, and Biba was 5 and 20 once again. I must tell you something, however, regarding her, and that is the worst. Biba came from a race of cannibals who inhabit one of the wildest and almost inaccessible regions of Bolivia, and her teeth had been filed by flints into a triangular shape, the form best adapted for tearing flesh. She had been brought thence, along with a couple of wonderful monkeys and several parrots, when only 16, by an English traveler who had intended to make her a present to his wife. Biba never got as far as England, however. She had watched her chance, and one day escaped to the woods, taking with her one of the monkeys, who was an especial favorite with this strange, wild girl. She was frequently seen for many years after this. It was supposed she had lived on roots and rats, I'm not joking, and slept at night in trees. She managed to clothe herself, too, with the inner rind of the bark of certain shrubs. But how she had escaped death from the talons of jaguars and other wild beasts no one could imagine. Well, one day, shortly after the arrival of St. Clair, hunters found the Jaguar Queen, as they called her, lying in the jungle at the foot of a tree. There was a jaguar not far off, and a huge piece of sodden flesh lay near Biba's cheek, undoubtedly placed there by this strange, wild pet, while close beside her stood a tapir. Biba was carried to the nearest village, and the tapir followed as gently as a lamb. My informant does not know what became of the tapir, but Biba was damned, turned a Christian too, and never evinced any inclination to return to the woods. Yet, strangely enough, no puma nor jaguar would ever even growl or snarl at Biba. These statements can all be verified. Chapter 4: Away Down the River. Before we start on this adventurous cruise, let us take a peep at an upland region to the south of the Amazon.
It was entirely surrounded by Quachucor India rubber trees, and it was while wandering through this dense forest with Jake, and making arrangements for the tapping of those trees, the juice of which was bound to bring the St. Clairs much money, that they came upon the rocky tableland where they found the gold. This was some months after the strange Indian had found the babes in the wood, as Jake sometimes called Roland and Peggy. I say, sir, do you see the quartz showing white everywhere through the bloom of those beautiful flowers? Ugh! Cried St. Clair, as a splendidly colored but hideous large snake hissed and glided away from between his feet. Ugh! Had I tramped on that fellow, my prospecting would have been all ended.
True, sir, said Jake, but about the quartz?
Well, Jake.
Well, Mr. St. Clair, there is gold here. I do not say that we've struck an El Dorado, but I am certain there is something worth digging for in this region.
Shall we try? You've been in Australia. What say you to a shaft?
Good. But a horizontal shaft carried into the base of this hill or hummock will, I think, do for the present. It is only for samples, you know.
And these samples had turned out so well that St. Clair, after claiming the whole hill, determined to send Jake on a special message to Barat to establish a company for working it. He could take no more labor on his own head, for really he had more than enough to do with his estate. No white men were allowed to work at the shaft. Only Indians, and these were housed on the spot. So that the secret was well kept. And now the voyage down the river was to be undertaken, and a most romantic cruise it turned out to be. St. Clair had ordered a steamer to be built for him in England and sent out in pieces. She was called underscore the Peggy underscore, after our heroine. Not very large but little over the dimensions of a large steam launch, in fact but big enough for the purpose of towing along the immense raft with the aid of the current. Jake was to go with his samples of golden sand and his nuggets, Burly Bill, also, who was captain of the underscore Peggy underscore, and Bibu, to attend to the youngsters in their raft saloon. Brawn was not to be denied, and last, but not least, went Wild Dick Temple. The latter was to sleep on board the steamer, but he would spend most of his time by day on the raft. All was ready at last. The great raft was floated and towed out far from the shore. All the plantation hands, both whites and Indians, were gathered on the banks, and gave many a lusty cheer as the steamer and raft got underway. The last thing that those on shore heard was the sonorous barking of the great wolfhound, Brawn. There was a ring of joy in it, however, that brought hope to the heart of both Tom St. Clair and his winsome wife. Well, to our two heroes and to Peggy, not to mention Brawn and Burly Bill, the cruise promised to be all one joyous picnic, and they set themselves to make the most of it. But to Jake Solomons it presented a more serious side. He was St. Clair's representative and trusted man, and his business was of the highest importance, and would need both tact and skill. However, there was a long time to think about all this, for the river does not run more than 3 miles an hour, and although the little steamer could hurry the raft along at probably thrice that speed, still long weeks must elapse before they could reach their destination. As far as the raft was concerned, this would not be Para. She would be grounded nearer to a town far higher upstream, and the timber, nuts, spices, and rubber taken seaward by train. In less than 2 days everyone had settled down to the voyage. The river was very wide and getting wider, and soon scarcely could they see the opposite shore, except as a long low green cloud on the northern horizon. Life on board the raft was for a whole week a most uneventful dreamy sort of existence. One day was remarkably like another. There was the blue of the sky above, the blue on the river's great breast, broken, however, by thousands of lines of rippling silver. There were strangely beautiful birds flying tack and half-tack around the steamer and raft, waving trees flower-bedraped the flowers trailing and creeping and climbing everywhere, and even dipping their sweet faces in the water, flowers of every hue of the rainbow. Dreamy though the atmosphere was, I would not have you believe that our young folks relapsed into a state of drowsy apathy. Far from it. They were very happy indeed. Dick told Peggy that their life, or his, felt just like some beautiful song waltz, and that he was altogether so happy and jolly that he had sometimes to turn out in the middle watch to laugh. Peggy had not to do that. In her little stateroom on one side of the cabin, and in a hammock, she slept as soundly as the traditional top, and on a grass mat on the deck, with a footstool for a pillow, slumbered Bibu. Roland slept on the other side, and Brawn guarded the doorway at the foot of the steps. Long before Peggy was awake, and every morning of their aquatic lives, the dinghy boat took the boys a little way out into midstream, and they stripped and dived, enjoyed a 2 minutes splash, and got quickly on board again. The men always stood by with rifles to shoot any alligator that might be seen hovering nigh,
and more than once reckless Dick had a narrow escape. But, he said one day in his comical way, one has only once to die, you know, and you might as well die doing a good turn as any other way.
Doing a good turn? Said Roland inquiringly.
Certainly. Do you not impart infinite joy to a caiman if you permit him to eat you?
The boys were always delightfully hungry half an hour before breakfast was served.
And it was a breakfast too.
Biba would be dressed betimes, and have the cloth laid in the saloon. The great raft rose and fell with a gentle motion, but there was nothing to hurt, so that the dishes stuck on the cloth without any guard.
Biba could be